Hello and welcome to our semi-weekly operational breakdown episode here at Colonial Outcast, where we use our collective military backgrounds and experience to debunk and expose military propaganda and to demonstrate the profound incompetence and clear genocidal intent of a particular nation state in the Eastern Mediterranean. I, myself, Greg Stoker, am joined with Mark Wayne and Travis, as per usual. What's up?
Hey, hey.
Oh, talkative today, are we?
We did this last time.
Oh man, we all missed the cue.
Sarge.
Look like a bunch of amateurs around here. We all do. Anyways, today we will be discussing Israel's bombing of an Iranian consulate in Damascus, Syria on April 1st. Don't know why they thought that would be a good idea. Maybe they were like, it's payday, so maybe we'll just like cut loose a little bit. But it only makes them more unreasonable looking, more like a bad actor. And what is the net benefit of such a drastic action? Because remember, another nation's consulate is considered that nation's sovereign soil. So bombing that embassy or consulate from a global security standpoint is like bombing Iran itself. So we're going to talk about all of that today, but through the lens of this super irresponsible and perfidious article published April 9th in Time magazine, written by Dan Raviv and Yossi Melman, entitled Israel's Dangerous Game with Iran. So for context about the writers, Ravi is a former CBS News correspondent. Melman in Tel Aviv is a defense and security analyst for Haaretz. Their latest book is, quote, Spies Against Armageddon, Inside Israel's Secret Wars, unquote. So if you're wondering if this article that we're about to systematically deconstruct is biased towards Israel, nah, dude, it's totally objective, analytical journalism. April Fools, just kidding. April Fools is on the 1st of April, you know, the day when Israel bombed the Iranian consulate. So, just what did you guys think of the article? We all read it before coming on today. Initial thoughts and feelings before we dive right in, paragraph by paragraph, and take it apart.
I mean,
I'll let Trav go first.
I was just going to say, the journalist almost managed to stay neutral sounding for like three whole paragraphs before they started pulling out stuff where I'm like, good Lord, even that would be considered spin by like any public affairs officer, even, you know, it's, attacking a consulate is kind of a big freaking deal. And they act like it's, oh no, it's just, you know, it's a targeted assassination, but you know, it's a military strike and they do this all the time. That's like, nobody else does that. You know, nobody else hits consulates in other countries. That's so wild, behaviorally.
But that's why they're so cool. They don't live by the rules.
Yeah.
They do what they want.
And then there's some cheese too that just cracks me up because it's like they're intelligent. What is it? They're technology driven intelligence agency. It's like, dude, it's 2024. there's not a lot of countries that aren't technology driven intelligence agencies. Yeah. So. They keep getting credit for things that to me are just really, really basic shit.
Yeah. All right. So let's just add this to stage and freaking send it.
All right. So one of the glaring things about this piece is that it's obviously designed to shift the public's attention and focus on Netanyahu's politics and gossip and put it on Netanyahu. His politics and the gossip surrounding him and taking it off the Palestinian suffering. It's like the best analogy I could think of at the time when I was reading it is like a family trapped in a burning house and the reporters on the scene. Instead, they take the cameras and go to the fire chief to kind of like capture the drama between him and his captain over administrative issues and not on the actual house that's burning with a family inside. You know, and this is my opinion. This is the liberals in the media seeking to retain their status as a progressive press by being critical of Netanyahu. So by focusing on Bibi, it gives them the ability to ignore Palestinian suffering while still technically kind of being left because they're against Bibi, who is on the right. So that's how I interpreted this article in the tone. It's trying to maintain that progressive edge to it because technically they're being critical of damn Bibi and his crazy decision makings and then completely taking off the focus of it.
100%. I also like if you pay close attention to where they attribute action, they give themselves away. That's really where it's given away, right? So if they talk about Lebanese border exchanges, they name Hezbollah. If they talk about Gaza, they name Hamas. But one of the things that's mentioned in the same paragraph of like all the things that are going on at the same time, right? Missile attacks from Yemen and Iraq. They say, and a quote, upsurge in violence in the West Bank. Who's causing the upsurge in violence in the West Bank? Who's doing that?
Yeah, that was the other thing. That was the other thing. I saw Israeli, violence. Violence. Who's doing the violence?
It's not the Palestinians. It's Israeli settlers, right? But they're not they're the only group in the whole paragraph that doesn't get named for their action, right? And that's where they give themselves away.
Spot on.
All right, but we're really going to dig into because they do a lot of shenanigans in this freaking article. So. The first two paragraphs I'm just going to read because they're not super objectionable at all. They're just background information. So to begin, the destruction of an entire building in Syria's capital on April 1st was impressively precise. See how competent the Air Force is of Israel? Whoever fired missiles at Iran's consular offices in Damascus, and anyone with an iota of experience knows it was Israel's Air Force, wanted to destroy that edifice and kill whoever was inside. Then came the information from Iran's government itself that amongst the dead was the vice commander of the Quds Force, the multinational spearhead of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the IRGC, along with senior officers who coordinated Iran's activities in Syria and Lebanon. All right, yeah, I mean, none of that's true. I mean, I like how they kind of, you know, soft float a compliment of the Israeli Air Force, you know.
Yeah, they're simping for them. They're simping of them. Who else but the Israeli Air Force?
Yeah, they also don't title the individual who was killed the way that they would title it. So if somebody had assassinated General Shinseki or somebody at a consulate in Lebanon, right, that headline would be read completely differently. That's not what they say.
No one claimed responsibility, but sources in Israeli intelligence tell us that the IRGC Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Zahedi was tracked by the Mossad and by Amman, Israel's technology-driven military intelligence agency, for years. And when Israel's spies were certain of where he was and whom he was with, they immediately wanted to take the shot. They had to get Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's approval, and despite all the current pressure on Israel, he readily agreed. That was a mistake. It was the right action, perhaps, but at the wrong time. So they have this idea that it was the right action at the wrong time. Okay, so the right action then being bomb someone's consulate without warning?
Yeah, I was just going to say time just went on record saying it's okay to strike diplomatic buildings in foreign countries. Okay, good to know.
Yeah, and I notice how they're trying to like hone in the narrative and the dispute over timing of it as opposed to doing it in any of Israel's actions. So,
but apparently it was the wrong time because I think, you know, Israel's clearly committing a genocide, so striking someone's embassy just makes them look a certain type of way, which is not good.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And we can see why Israel's military, or excuse me, we can see why the Israelis wanted to do it. When they looked back at how America assassinated the charismatic head of the Quds Force, Major General Qassem Soleimani, a daring decision made by President Donald Trump in January 2020, with a small Israeli role in tracking their quarry, they considered that the Iran's response was little more than bluster. Okay, so what they're talking about is how the former head of the Quds Force, Soleimani, was assassinated during Donald Trump's presidency by Americans.
Yeah, they killed him. I think they killed him at Baghdad Airport.
Yeah, but this is really important because for the audience, because it establishes the relationship between Iran and the West and the history behind it. So Soleimani was an Iranian military officer who served in the IRGC. His assassination in 2020, he was the commander of the Quds Force, an IRGC division primarily responsible for extraterritorial and clandestine military operations, and played a key role in the Syrian civil war through securing Russian intervention. So he was described as the single most powerful operative in the Middle East and a genius of asymmetric warfare. So For attacks orchestrated or attempted against American and other targets abroad, Soleimani was personally sanctioned by the United Nations and the EU and was designated as a terrorist by the United States in 2005. The United States military assassinated Soleimani in a targeted drone strike on January 3rd in Baghdad, Iraq. Iranian government officials publicly mourned Soleimani's death and launched missiles against U.S. military bases in Iraq, wounding 110 American troops. So when they say they consider that Iran's response was little more than bluster, 110 American troops were, I tracked down the sources for all these articles and stuff. So this military airstrike or this ballistic missile strike that Iran did in response was called Operation Martyr Soleimani. And people think it was like little more than bluster because a lot of those industry, a lot of those injuries, excuse me, were only like TBIs and stuff, and there were no fatalities. So people thought it was just like a performative show of force. And it's like, okay, fine, but we just did a performative show of force against Iran in retribution for killing three American troops via proxies, apparently. In a Jordan, in a, at an air base in Jordan or Syria, most likely. So, that happened a few months ago, 85 targeted strikes against, Iranian backed militias. Nothing was really hit. It was a smoke and mirrors show. So the implication is that this Martyr Soleimani ballistic missile strike was similar. It was a matter of hitting back, but not wanting to escalate. So it was all kind of performative, and we tell our respective medias, whatever we want to tell them.
Yeah, I mean, two pieces I would take out of that I think are not quite on the level. The first is, you know, our U.S. actions in declaring Soleimani a terrorist in the first place. So Soleimani's role in military operations, if you're American and you're familiar with Green Berets, that's essentially the type of organization that he leads, right? Soleimani, for example, was active. The Quds forces that he commands were active, you know, training Shia militias in Iraq and other places, like Greg just mentioned, you know, to fight U.S. troops and other NATO troops. But and then the second piece is it's kind of wild to me to call an attack that wounded, you know, 100 and change U.S. soldiers in a single event. Smoke or bluster, because by our own wound rates, that's pretty damn high, right? I mean, what do you think, Mark? Like, I don't think anyone would go 100 soldiers were wounded in this incident. It's minor. That doesn't make any sense in our own narratives.
And TBI is no joke. That's major brain injury going on right there. And I was listening to a podcast at Breaking Points. They were talking about how that was so downplayed, you know? The idea of a TBI is not that that means the soldiers are going home with major traumatic injuries that's going to affect them for the rest of their lives with their families. So it's nothing to shake a stick at. All right, Greg, are you able to pull that article back up on your screen?
Yeah.
It's not okay, on there anymore.
Sorry, I had to log back in. But yeah, I mean, that's how the Times article was framing it. You know, they said it was the Iranian response was little more than bluster. So, again, they're framing it's like, ooh, Iran can't really clap back at all, or, you know, doesn't have the capabilities to do that. So right now, however, with the war in Gaza, a costly and painful burden for 6 months and counting, Netanyahu is risking a much wider war. He is stirring the hornet's nest, represented already by rocket attacks on Israel by Iranian proxies in Lebanon and in far-off Yemen and Iraq. Hours after the explosion in Damascus last week, many of Israel's almost 10 million people went into panic, hearing pundits in the media predict a massive retaliation by Iran. Israelis stocked up on food and rushed to ATMs to draw cash from their accounts in case of all-out war. So, I mean, they scrambled GPS signals within Israel. People were buying, like, toilet paper. Everybody was bracing for an assault because that's what they're not saying behind any of this, is that all of the Iranian militias or Iranian-backed militias in Iraq and Syria and Lebanon could overwhelm their Iron Dome, and Iran itself could shoot ballistic missiles that could overwhelm and masses that can overwhelm the David Sling air defense programs. We had on a previous operational breakdown, we read internal reporting from their own think tanks that involved hundreds of IDF officers who said the same thing. They know they're vulnerable to missile attack.
And it's not just missile attack, right? You called it out. Like, it's missile attack, it's multi-force rocket attacks, and it's also they also have a highly advanced more highly advanced drone militaries that exist, right? Pretty much, if you're not using NATO equipment, you're using Iranian drones right now. That's who's building them.
I mean, that's what Russia's using right now in Ukraine. They're buying them off of Iran and shooting them at Ukrainian forces. And Ukrainian forces are supposed to be near peer, you know?
Yeah, you're right. Those Iranian drones are the ones that they're using to hit infrastructure all over Ukraine. So
now my question, so just to confirm the numbers, Hezbollah has 150K precision guided missiles, correct? Is that number accurate or is that an exaggeration?
That's the generally accepted open source number.
They're calling it, and they're saying precision guided munition or missile, because those are
missiles. Okay. Precision guided, 150,000 precision guided missiles. So
yeah, I mean, maybe, yeah, for sure.
That would easily overwhelm. And I've been wondering, and I have a question for you guys. Do you all the tit for tat that's been going across the border between Lebanon and Israel right now? Do you guys see that as Hezbollah testing Israel's defenses right now, just feeling it out? You know,
I think they're keeping the front active, one, and two, there have been effective strikes using anti-tank missiles, lower, we talked about this before, lower flying, flatter trajectory, anti-tank munitions to knock out Iron Dome sites. So some of it has been kinetic with actual effect.
Yeah.
And a lot of it to me looks like keeping a front active.
I see it as kind of like a boxer, you know, when he's sparring a little bit just to see what the opponent is able to do and just feeling out the air defense system a little bit so they can map it out.
It does look like jabs. You're right. It looks like jabs, right? Yeah.
Also, what they're doing is a lot of escalation management. They're just keeping up pressure on the northern front so Israel doesn't forget about them. They're displacing tens of thousands of settlers in the north. It's an economic drain. It's a pain in the ass. It keeps the general public in a state of panic because they cannot forget for a moment that they're at war, not just with Hamas in Gaza, but with a superior military force to the north. So yeah, that's part of it. And right now, the word on the street is that U.S. ambassadors to the Lebanese government are trying to pressure Lebanese officials to convince Hezbollah or to force Hezbollah, which they can't do, to pull up north to behind the Litani River in Lebanon. And of course, according to the Cradle media, the Lebanese government's response was it would be easier moving the Litani River to Hezbollah than for Hezbollah to move north to the Litani River. Yeah.
That's so true.
Yeah. So,
yeah, that's not going to happen.
He's not lying. I mean,
that's just the reality of the situation. Hezbollah is the most powerful non-state military actor on the planet. Yeah. Yeah.
The Lebanese government is not in charge of that.
Yeah, not at all. So a fresh round of panic was the last thing the people of Israel needed. Half a year after the Hamas attack of last October 7th, with its massacres and the kidnappings of over 200 hostages, Netanyahu probably saw flattening an Iranian building in Syria as part of restoring Israel's deterrence, meaning its ability to intimidate its hostile neighbors. And as we've mentioned before, this idea of deterrence and deterrence capacity is so incredibly important to Israeli existential security, because the myth of the IDF being the most powerful, the Mossad being the most omniscient intelligence source or agency, has been really important to mindfucking its neighbors into thinking that, you know, it's this impregnable fortress of a nation state. But October 7th has destroyed any notion that that's actually true. It was a massive intelligence failure. It was an epically massive military failure. Like, Apache pilots were trying to get targeting information on WhatsApp because, like, the military intelligence architecture was just non-existent. So the blood's in the water. So they're trying to do things to get their deterrence capacity back, like doing targeted strikes into Beirut to kill like a Hamas official, and now this consulate attack in Damascus. But I don't think there's anything that they can do to get their deterrence capacity back, because they need to defeat like Hezbollah, which they definitely can't do if they can't defeat Hamas.
And by the way, like, also think of the demoralization on the IDF side versus the definite encouragement on Hezbollah side. So you, for example, you, Greg, sometimes you'll be able to see, you know, footage from Hamas in Gaza and their successful strikes against Israeli targets, right? Well, you're seeing that as an American. Imagine what Hezbollah is seeing on their channels. They're seeing all kinds of successful strikes against Israeli targets from Hamas. So imagine how their Hezbollah fighters are getting pumped up for this and getting encouraged and seeing Israel's weakness way more than you and I are. And meanwhile, the IDF, they're getting demoralized on the ground in Gaza by seeing, you know, their weaknesses on a daily basis, you know. So there's that morale factor there that's, you know, a huge piece of the pie that you will not see in any of these articles.
It definitely took, they definitely lost a lot of the mystique. Like, you know, you're talking about their aura of deterrence or their aura of their ability to deter attacks. And I think they've definitely lost a lot of that credibility. So, right, obviously the first one, the obvious one that we've already called out, the intelligence failure, the massive intelligence failure. You had multiple forces penetrate through multiple places on your border wall, right, and then attack multiple targets simultaneously while taking out observation posts, drone striking, you know, striking with dismounts, et cetera, all very coordinated attack, and you miss the entire thing, which is an incredible intelligence failure. But the second piece to your point, Mark, is where we've been watching their forces operate in an urban environment for 6 months now, and I'm watching them get beat by, a force that they've basically been choking, for 75 years, that has way less capacity than Hezbollah, does not have significant anti-tank weapons with standoff. They have short-range anti-tank that they're using to great effect. But Hezbollah has, we were talking about this. Hamas is doing damage to Israeli mech units with 100-meter standoff, shoulder-launched, you know, RPG-based weapon systems and some EFPs. Hezbollah has
$200 a piece.
Yeah, Hezbollah has 10-kilometer capable video optically guided anti-tank missiles. Entirely different capacity in pre-dug positions.
And the tunnel network is probably even way more vast than that of Gaza's.
So if I'm Hezbollah watching Israeli mech forces, I am not afraid of you crossing the Lebanese border. I wouldn't be.
Inversely, on the IDF side, they're getting demoralized by seeing their weakness. And, you know, like, so IDF forces are coming out of France and England and the US. They're not hardened like Hezbollah at all. So
that puts this consulate strike in context for me, because to me, it looks like a bully who just got his ass kicked and is now, you know, found something else to pick on or somebody else to hit in the cafeteria. Yeah. Like, that's what it looks like. It looks like somebody lashing out. It doesn't look like a coherent, reasoned, strategic response to me.
So that's the whole thing about Israeli deterrence. Again, to repeat the first sentence, Netanyahu probably saw flattening an Iranian building in Syria as part of restoring Israel's deterrence, but as is typical of Israel's longest serving prime minister, Netanyahu's main concern is with his own image. Yeah, he's a political animal and survivalist. He wants to look bold in the wake of a security and intelligence failure for which he must share the blame. I mean, yeah, obviously. He hasn't stopped playing politics for a second. Since the trauma of the worst attack on Jews since the Nazi Holocaust, of course, got to fit that one in there, and every hour of every day, he is seeking to reverse his vulnerable political fortune. Now, none of this is incorrect. Of course, they had to bring up the Holocaust because, you know, why not? But I think if fair is fair, you also have to bring up the Nakba, which they'd never do. But this idea of him seeking to reverse his vulnerable political fortune, never in this article, I don't believe, unless I'm completely mistaken, and we'll see soon enough, do they talk about him keeping this going in order to avoid corruption charges for trying to dismantle the Supreme Court?
Yeah, they also say, like, oh, he must share some of the blame. And it's like, what was one of the major reasons that the reserve forces of Israel were not ready for the October 7th attack? Well, because a lot of them had basically threatened to quit, refused to come to drill, refused to show up. Yeah. Because of the court bullshit that Netanyahu's and his party were pushing, where they were trying to rewrite some of the legal system to benefit themselves. And there was a lot of like, there's a lot of senior officers and military refusing to serve out of protest. That was going on right beforehand. He almost single-handedly weakened their military on top of, all the other failures.
But, and again, that's why I see this article as simply a way of stoking the controversy around Bibi and taking the focus off of Gaza and just the general, bad acting that Israel is doing altogether, as a, keeping the controversy on Bibi and his actions and not just the general system of what the fuck they're doing in that entire region.
Yeah. I mean, I speed read this twice. I don't think they really focus too much on the absolute devastation of Gaza. But we'll see soon enough. In recent days,
not at all.
Yeah,
no.
Yeah. In recent days, the families of the Israeli hostages held by Hamas stepped up their pressure campaign for a negotiated prisoner swap by turning explicitly against Netanyahu. They declared that the prime minister failed to protect their loved ones and is now abandoning them again by playing politics and caring only about his own standing. Not untrue, the hostage families, a small but newly influential factor in the Israeli political opinion, say Netanyahu needs to resign. They don't even want to wait for scheduling an election, which is what Senator Chuck Schumer stunningly urged in his recent speech. Okay, first of all, I want to say one thing about the protests, and that is they're not for ceasefire. They're not for stopping genocide or the war or reevaluating anything. They just want the hostages back. That's it. There is a small,
and then continue the genocide.
There actually is a small leftist minority that is protesting, but it's not enough to move the needle. It's not even something you can call a silent minority.
Yeah.
And they're
all losing their jobs.
Yeah. Oh, and getting arrested. Fascist kind of fascist. But I like how they highlight like Senator Chuck Schumer taking the most lukewarm stance ever, saying Israel needs an election. He's not even calling for a ceasefire. Senator Chuck Schumer is not even calling for a ceasefire. He's just saying we need elections. Yeah.
Again, that was one of the sentences that really, tips you off that this article is engineered to create the controversy around Bibi Netanyahu, his elections and all that, like by saying Chuck Schumer is stunningly, like as if that's a controversial move to say, like, I don't know how Americans are going to feel about this if he's telling another country to move up their elections. It's like, again, I'm going to go back to my fucking burning house analogy. And we lost Greg again. It must be one hell of a hailstorm going on. Jesus.
They asked him, I don't know if he moved to his new place yet or not, but I hope this isn't his new place's internet.
Okay, I'm back.
Is this like the hailstorm from Egypt in the 10 plagues?
It might be.
Well, I was at the eclipse yesterday. I just turned on a VPN, and I came back. So we'll see what happened.
That was a lame eclipse, by the way. That was freaking lame. From the United States perspective.
Dude, anyway. I was in Austin,
Texas. We had a clear shot for you.
I was outside watching the whole thing. I'm like, where is the dark? Is it get dark? It didn't get dark at all. I had to use my sunglasses to try to see a little sliver of California. So I figured I'd be able to see something.
I don't think you're on the totality line. It went diagonal, like through central Texas and into Mexico.
Oh shit! Well, it was very anticlimactic.
For us, we saw like the full on corona of the sun.
Oh yeah, no, I didn't get that. I didn't get any of that. It was such a tease.
All right, sorry. Where were we? I think I finished that paragraph with talking shit about Schumer.
Talking about Chuck Schumer's brave stance.
Yeah.
Yeah, his brave stance, controversial, provocative.
Okay, so are we good to continue? All right. Joe Biden obviously agrees with Schumer, because Bibi isn't listening. While the president did, quote-unquote, strong-arm Netanyahu into stepping up humanitarian aid deliveries to the Palestinians of Gaza in the wake of the terrible Israeli mistake of killing several central kitchen workers, Biden has not gotten Netanyahu to agree to other key steps aimed at reducing bloodshed. Okay, so first of all, there's a lot to unpack in this really wordy sentence. Okay, Joe Biden obviously doesn't want to work with Netanyahu. I mean, he's you know, talking to the foremost opposition leader right now. Having they brought him to Washington a couple weeks ago, so they're positioning him to kind of take over, hopefully. But this idea that these writers think that President Biden strong-armed Netanyahu into stepping up aid is fucking laughable.
Yeah, I that was one of my things I highlighted on my notes on that. Like, so this I cannot stand this whole idea, this narrative that in any way, shape, or form has Biden been firm with Israel or Bibi Netanyahu. And my other analogy on that is, it's like if my child picked up a gun and started shooting people, right? And I'm like, hey, there, son. Like, what did I tell you about guns? And he's like, Dad, I'm out of ammo. All right, what do you want? You want hollow points or do you want a metal jacket?
Yeah, exactly.
I want hollow points. All right, here's some more ammo. And hey, you know, I said about guns, right? And then, you know, it's like, hey, listen, stop shooting people. Okay, get out of here, sport. Hmm. You know, and then I got my eye on you, buddy. And everyone's like, wow, he's really putting pressure on his son these days.
Well, I mean, why would he have any credible threat, right? Why would the president have any credible threat? The vast majority of both parties is in AIPAC's pocket and openly supportive of Israel. So,
and they're all voting to keep arming Israel.
What is the president going to do? Not sign a defense spending bill, which Congress will pass anyway. You know what I mean?
Well, it's like that. The Elizabeth Warren, right? She was on camera talking about, you know, the intricacies of is it a genocide or not? And she was like, it might probably will be considered a genocide in a ruling in the future. It's like, then why the fuck are you voting to keep arming the genocide? She was voting to arm the genocide while publicly saying this is probably going to be a genocide.
Yeah, you know, it's wild too, because it keeps getting put in the same frame as Ukraine, and it's like Ukraine has a front that if you don't keep arming and supplying them, they'll get overrun, right? The people in Gaza that are being slaughtered right now are not going to suddenly overwhelm Tel Aviv if we don't send 8,000 artillery shells next month. That's not going to happen. There's no credible threat there right now, even if that was the logic that you were using to continue funding someone who, by her own words, might be committing a genocide, right? You know, like, Ukraine will lose if you cut support, or could lose if you cut support. Israel's not going anywhere. So it's just such BS.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what would strong arming actually look like? Enforcing the Leahy laws, saying that we cannot by law arm a country that might be in violation of international humanitarian law. So you can start by doing that, and you can use your executive authority to coerce AIPAC to register as a foreign agent. That's what strong arming would look like. So anyways, so another part of this sentence was, quote, in the wake of terrible Israeli mistake of killing 7 World Central Kitchen workers. I mean, Travis, was it a terrible mistake?
I haven't bought that from the first time I read the description of the ground description of what happened. You don't hit 3 vehicles in a row over a course of time. You know, you hit one vehicle, people try to get into another vehicle. All of them are marked. They've pre-cleared themselves. I've seen stupid things happen, right? With bad sector clearance, or, you know, units not telling each other where they are and what they're doing. But I've never seen that happen 3 times in succession on the same, you know, on the same group.
Yeah.
So I do not believe that.
So did you hear about their official explanation about what it was? Did you hear about that? Why they said the mistake? They said the mistake was made, and it was confession. It was both a confession and a, you know, poor explanation. But the explanation was that they had intel that there may have been a Palestinian male in one of the vehicles. Now, that alone was a confession, because they're saying that their rule of thumb is that if there's a Palestinian male, they're automatically treated as a Hamas terrorist. And then, you know, their protocol is to destroy it, right? So that by giving their explanation of what happened to excuse themselves about the mistake, they were at the same time confessing that they're just killing males.
Your only defense as an aid agency is to make sure that you're visibly all white on IR. Right?
Exactly.
It's the only way you won't get drone strike 3 times over the course of an hour.
Yeah. And you know, I used to be involved in the targeting of kinetic strikes in Afghanistan. So I know how it works. I was on like the more intel side of things. But the last check about what happens before a missile is shot is you have these really advanced sensors that even under IR, which is infrared, which is, you know, a nighttime camera for the layman, you can see demarcated on the top of each one of these cars, World Central Kitchen. So a drone pilot, which is the last check, and his commanding officer who authorizes it, is seeing World Central Kitchen on top of each one of those cars and shooting it. Not once, three times. How is that a mistake? Like, I mean, okay, so like, let's pretend it was a mistake. So either, okay. Well
and they didn't strike the same target three times, right? They shot one vehicle.
Yeah.
The people tried to get out and recover into another vehicle. They hit that one, and then they happened again, and they hit a third. Yeah. I mean, I don't.
And this is not happening from 300 miles in the stratosphere. No. This is happening from low altitude.
Yeah. Also, if we just assume that, you know, maybe it was a mistake, you know, they're too incompetent to arm. Like, that is some incompetence that I've never seen. So either they're in violation of humanitarian laws and they're committing war crimes, so we can't arm them, or they're too incompetent to arm. But, you know, that's just beside the point. Moving on, Biden has not gotten Netanyahu to agree to other steps aimed at reducing bloodshed, a softer stand in negotiations aimed at freeing hostages, believed to include 5 U.S. citizens, dual citizens, not to say they're not U.S. citizens, but they're also Israeli citizens as well, which the article chooses not to specify, abandoning plans to enter the last Hamas stronghold, the city of Rafah. By the way, we know this isn't the last Hamas stronghold because Hamas just put out a bunch of timestamp geolocated videos of them operating both in the north and in Khan Yunis, which is not in Rafah, unless somehow more than 1 million Gazan refugees can be safely moved, which they can't because they have nowhere to go. They're up against the last wall. And helping to lay plans for reconstruction and governance in Gaza aimed at paving the way for an independent Palestinian state. They also failed to mention that this Palestinian state would have to be demilitarized, which is untenable. Netanyahu refuses to assent to a two-state solution. Palestine, living alongside Israel as a sovereign nation, an extreme Jewish nationalist in his cabinet, won't go along with any concessions. Right, they won't. So it's a stalemate. And, you know, since the U.S. is actually not strong-arming anybody or anything, this deadlock will continue. If any sanity was going to happen, I think a ceasefire should have happened in New Year's or like early February. But no, they just keep chugging along. Okay, against this background is a long-standing strategy of the Mossad and other security agencies: targeted assassinations. It was Pavlovian reaction when the spies locked onto British Brigadier General Zahedi's precise location. We found him. Let's kill him. That's just some apologism for a freaking stupid political decision, in my opinion. Oh, you know, it's a Pavlovian reaction. When the spies found him, they had to kill him. That's just what spies do.
I thought part of this was really telling too, because they mentioned somewhere, I think it's either here or a little bit down, where they're like, they didn't actually hit the consulate. They hit an apartment block next to the consulate and precisely killed him and, you know, just the people in that building. And it's like, oh, so you are capable of doing that without dropping 2,000-pound bombs on apartment blocks.
I was going to say, this whole article, you know, is a confession.
Yeah.
This whole article is a confession on their precision capabilities.
Yeah, exactly. It's like you totally can do precision strikes. You're just not doing it, which we all obviously know. Anyone who's dealt with any kind of this kind of fire or targeting, we already know. And also to comment on what you said earlier, Greg, about there being Hamas, you know, if their last stronghold is clearly not in Rafah. They're in the north, they're in the middle, they're in the south. It's almost like large scale aerial bombing campaigns in urban environments aren't a good form of counterinsurgency tactics. It's almost like that doesn't work. Yeah. Ever. Duh.
Yeah.
So, and continuing, they certainly had found a potent enemy. Iran incurs the Shiite Muslim fighters of Lebanon's Hezbollah to keep firing rockets and anti-tank shells at northern Israel since last October, compelling tens of thousands of Israelis to leave their homes and reside temporarily in hotels in communities many miles away, from which there have been a ton of sexual assault allegations against children living in displaced hotels. Anyways, Iran also clearly gave the green light to the Houthi rebels of Yemen to fire missiles at ships in the Red Sea and even at the Israeli port of Eilat to show support for the embattled Palestinians in Gaza. It's kind of laughable that they think that Iran completely and effectively controls fucking Ansar Allah, a.k.a. the Houthis. Does anyone else have an issue with that freaking assumption?
Yeah, I think if they can shut down, you know, the passages from the Red Sea and have to make, you know, shipping to go all the way around Africa, I'm pretty sure they don't need Iran to tell them how to do that.
No. But also, I have a problem with this language because it assumes a unilateral and monolithic relationship between Iran and all of these different militias and organizations. Like, Iran's not going to have the same control over a freaking small militant group in Iraq than it has over freaking the Houthis or Hezbollah. Like, they're constructing what I like to call the Iranian octopus. Like, Iran is controlling all these groups. It's like, have you ever worked with insurgents? Like, if you think you can control them completely, you're just insane. Like, that's an insane assumption to paint Iran's control as unilateral across all of these groups and all of these fronts.
Absolutely, yeah, 100% agree. Iran is not giving daily instructions to these guys. They're not giving daily plans. They're not giving direct orders. Right? They do have a high degree of influence. I think we did see some of that in Iraq recently, where, you know, it looked like Iran was like, you need to cut it out for a couple of days because you're escalating.
Wait. So you're saying that Iran didn't tell the Houthis to film a music video on the deck of that ship?
Yeah, for sure. No, I mean,
they weren't directing that music video.
PAO guy, but you know, they obviously do have a high degree of influence, but that's not the same thing as control or responsibility.
Israel's military and intelligence services wanted to give Iran a bloody nose, but cooler heads have prevailed. If you think Biden has a cool head, he's just senile. Biden told everyone in the Middle East to avoid a wider war and anchored U.S. Navy warships in the Eastern Med to underline the American message. Yet Netanyahu and the Mossad couldn't resist the temptation. After all, there's a long history of Israel literally getting away with murder. At least they make that confession. And at least they are right.
Yeah, that was surprising.
America doing its own escalation. Yeah, at least they're correct about America and the American Navy doing its own form of escalation management in the Red Sea. No boots got put on the ground. They're not doing crazy strikes into civilian areas. They're just, you know, shooting shit now and then. So, yep, nobody wants a wider conflict. I think CENTCOM, U.S. Central Command, and Iran have both proven over the course of this conflict, aka genocide, they don't want to escalate beyond a certain threshold.
Yeah, totally agree. I mean, you call it the Navy's large scale but limited strikes, right? They're going to do a series of targets and then stop, you know, for weeks. Iran has done the same thing through its proxies, directly, et cetera. But yeah, their behavior is remarkably similar because they obviously want the same outcome here.
No, I love how in this next paragraph it's just a big list of simping. Of admiration for the Mossad and their capabilities and not listing any of the fucked up shit that they've done against civilians and against innocent people. It's just all these people listed were like guilty, like the Nazi officer in 1956, you know, they always list these romanticized scenarios that the Mossad operate in and never the just senseless and bloody and murderous actions they've taken against innocent people. But
Then they finish it with, and the Jewish state does not want to be considered a worldwide murder agency. Well, you're not doing a very good job of that.
Too late.
Yeah. Targeted killings by Israeli intelligence can be traced back to 1956. Blah, blah, blah. Bomb in Egypt. Something guerrillas crossing the border. Something about Uruguay. After PLO terrorists murdered 11 Israeli athletes. Okay. Yeah. at the Olympic Games in Munich in 1972. That did happen. The Mossad assassinated Palestinian activists in half a dozen countries. The so-called revenge campaign, made famous by Steven and romanticized, again, as Mark said, by Steven Spielberg's movie Munich. Senior men in Arab radical groups that attacked Israel were assassinated from time to time, but Mossad officials have always told us that killings were a last resort. Really? That's coming from Mossad? Anyways, they much prefer to capture, interrogate, and if possible, blackmail enemies through Epstein Island. Just kidding. The article, I don't want to get charged with libel. The article doesn't say that last part about the island. Capture, interrogate, and if possible, blackmail enemies and turn them into double agents. Israeli leaders want to avoid obvious violation of foreign laws. No, they don't. And the Jewish state does not want to be considered a worldwide murder agency. I mean, even if they are, they don't want to be, because you see what's happening right now. The global South and the world is turning against them. That's why they don't want to be. Yeah, that's true. They don't want to be. Doesn't mean they aren't.
This entire paragraph is completely ignoring Gaza out of the context. It's as if it's not happening at all. Like, none of the shit happening in Gaza is happening as they're talking about this. As if the only stuff happening in the world in that region is this, tit for tat between Iran and Israel.
Well, that's all, from the viewpoint that this is being written from, or from the viewpoint of our administration, stuff like that, that is all they care about, right? Gaza isn't on the radar. They wish it would go away. They wish it would drop out of the news, as far as Biden's concerned, or, other Iran is concerned. This is, let's not escalate the proxy wars between two giant, between two hegemons. Can one of you rein in, your ally, so to speak? But yeah, they don't care. They're not writing about it because they don't care. It's not, it's not relevant to the actors in the story, which is sick.
Yeah. Time is a joke.
Yeah. And then they say, next paragraph, yet in Iran, desperate to stop that country's secret but active drive to build nuclear weapons, Israeli agents assassinated more than half a dozen scientists and engineers connected with a nuclear program. Its top scientist, Mohsen, I don't speak Persian very well anymore, but Farikzadeh, was the most recent known victim, killed in 2019 by a remote-controlled robot gun, sounds very Israeli, parked at the side of a road in Iran. Israel has never determined what its rules of engagement should be. Duh, it's to target civilians to put pressure on the militants to lay down their arms. That's the rules of engagement. But when it comes to targeted assassinations, after publicly embarrassing failure on a mission aimed at poisoning a Hamas leader in Jordan in 1997, a parliamentary subcommittee tried to define an assassination doctrine. I love how they admit to having an assassination doctrine. Netanyahu was prime minister at the time, and he and other government leaders failed to move ahead, even though the panel wrote that the policy was needed for combating terrorist organizations based on rigorous thought and consistent logic. Depending on killing prominent even enemy individuals has taken on great and damaging weight, the Knesset members wrote. Yeah, because targeting foreign officials and obviously killing them because the Mossad isn't as sleek as they like to be in movies looks bad in the international community. You got to get away with it, in order to be like big and scary and not catch flack. So, there in Damascus, Israeli intelligence saw a ripe target. Again, coming back to the strike on April 1st. Even more invitingly, he was meeting with other men who were directing Iran and Hezbollah's simmering war on Israel. Ooh, it's getting spicy. A simmering war. The air is filled with musk. Netanyahu didn't stop the Mossad's Pavlovian response. They're using freaking like almost
debunked Pavlovian psychology. Twice. That's two times I know. You use Pavlovian.
It's really not the Mossad's fault. It's Pavlov's fucking theory. That's who Pavlov's theory is. Hamas, even though he and his country are already coping with a six front war, the death and destruction in Gaza, that the only mention of it, sparked by, and they have to qualify it with, sparked by the historically awful Hamas incursion.
Yeah, this is the paragraph where they noticeably don't name certain actors. Death and destruction in Gaza, no actor named. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, an upsurge in violence in the West Bank.
Oh, who's doing that?
Oh, is it the settlers? Okay, the Lebanese border exchanges of fire. Hezbollah, again, is targeting mostly overwhelmingly military targets. The IDF is not. And then a long streak of unacknowledged Air Force attacks on Iranian affiliated targets in Syria. I mean, we know for a fact that mostly civilians were also targeted. And the long range missiles from Yemen and Iraq. Netanyahu is also in a diplomatic war with Joe Biden. And European leaders who expressed great sympathy after October 7th are now turning against what Israel's been doing in Gaza. That is the most fuckery I've seen in a journalistic paragraph in a hot minute, guys.
Did you see how long it took him to get there? That's the first. That's like the first first concrete mention of an ongoing genocide. It took him like 13 freaking paragraphs to get there.
Yeah, amazing. We're like almost an hour in, and it fucking yeah. Okay, we got three left. So just like we don't have enough time to unpack that. We just know it's problematic as fuck. Continuing, yet Netanyahu took the risk of opening another front by striking an Iranian consulate. Oh, yeah, he did. Finally, some like worthy analysis from this fucking article. Iran, vowing revenge directly against Israel, naturally says the building, they qualify it with naturally, Iran, or okay, sorry, against Israel, naturally saying the building under diplomatic protocols was Iran's sovereign territory. What do you mean saying? It was. It was a freaking consulate. Israel's That's officials minimized the violation. Israeli officials minimized the violation by telling us that it was just an apartment building next door to Iran's unscathed embassy, but we have fucking pictures. Tell that to the anti-aircraft and anti-missile system operators in Israel, now on high alert for any incoming attack from the east. Tell that to the Israeli civilians whose new round of panic included cleaning and preparing their bomb shelters, you know, right under the freaking EDM fucking factory or whatever. Tell that to the hostage families who want a primary focus on rescuing the innocent captives, even as officials quietly opine that fewer than 60 of the 103 on the list are likely still alive. Yep, see, everything's focused around the hostages and the suffering and the panic of the Israeli people. One sentence about death and destruction in Gaza, but they just spent like half a paragraph on like Israeli civilians.
Yeah, so that's a great point, right? That's what they're mad about. They're not mad about genocide. They're not mad about anything else. But it's like, oh no, you scared the Israeli population, or you possibly put the Israeli population under more threat by doing this. That's the only thing we care about. I also think it's interesting they're pointing out, you know, likely only 60 of the 133 hostages are still alive. Why would that be? Is it because aerial carpet bombing is not a great hostage rescue tactic? I don't know, man. I mean,
starvation as a weapon. Yeah. I mean, starvation as a weapon, maybe something. A destruction of all medical infrastructure, maybe that too. Oh, yeah, and fucking carpet bombing. So, continuing, we can see that the Mossad wanted some action. they wanted a taste.
No, I'd say the last one you read, notice how there's absolutely no sympathy for America getting involved. Like they talk about how Israeli civilians or the drone or the anti-air, the air defense operators, no mention of concern of us getting dragged into it.
Yep.
So you see a lack of concern for American interest in this article as well. Like, who cares? Who cares if we get dragged into a war? It's just our boys and girls, you know? So it's very much patriotic for Israel, this whole article. It's Israel patriotic, Israel focused, no concern about the American interest, you know?
I keep looking up to see if this is Jerusalem Daily and realizing, oh, yeah, that's right.
To be part of the battles that began last October. The head of the agency, David Barnea, has seemingly been relegated to the role of a messenger as he flies to Qatar and to Egypt to take part in mediation sessions with CIA Director William Burns. Hamas negotiators are in separate rooms when talks are underway in Doha and Cairo. Even as Israelis and Americans evolved, wonder if the Hamas men of violence in the tunnels of Gaza will ever honor whatever agreements might be reached. Travis, send it.
Yeah, that was wild. After reading an entire article about the Pavlovian Mossad agents who can't help murdering foreign officials and diplomats, you know, on in consulates and in apartment buildings in foreign countries, it's the guys in the tunnels getting the ever loving shit bombed out of them in an ongoing genocide that are the men of violence. Men of violence. The language here just blows my mind. Again, I keep looking to go like, is this the Jerusalem Post? No, it's Time. Holy shit, you know? An honor, whatever agreements might be reached. Yeah, because in the long history of violating agreements and failing to meet, you know, signed treaties, oh yeah, sure, we won't settle, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, it's definitely the Palestinians that are on the wrong side of that history. Good sentence,
I think
Time.
This, great work. Yeah, I think this sentence is the most absurd in the entire article. I think this takes the
cake. You just talked about the Mossad smoking dudes for like the last 70 years and multiple iterations of them killing people and extortion and
and what little defense that the Gazans have left, what little actions they can take is considered violence. It's considered the men of violence. It's like,
yeah,
that'd be considered like the National Guard. If California was invaded by China, the National Guard would be considered men of violence before protecting them.
If someone's standing on my neck and you don't stop them, don't criticize how I get them off my neck. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So that's the worst sentence of the article. We got one paragraph left. Thank bejesus. So, a central decision maker in all this mess is Benjamin Bibi Netanyahu. He looms large with his ego, his resentment at the political foes in the media he labels as fake news, and the fact that he is on trial for alleged fraud involving bribes. Okay, they finally mentioned that. It is a slow-moving legal process, but one that is clearly motivated his refusal to call an early election. None is required until October 2026. Let that sink in. We could be looking at this guy for a minute. While Israeli society is marred by a combustible mix of angry and divided citizens, and despite his terrible poll ratings, Netanyahu keeps hanging on to power by his fingernails. If he thought angering Joe Biden, violating diplomatic norms, and risking a longer and wider war could help him, Israel's prime minister is willing to take the shot. That's like one of the only things in this article I agree with. Bibi will keep this shit continuing for his own existential political survival.
It's an Israel-centric viewpoint, right? It's an Israel-centric viewpoint. They're mad about Bibi, and they're just like they're mad about, hey, you caused a threat to Israeli citizens. They don't care about anything else. But yeah, no wonder they're focusing on Netanyahu.
They didn't mention the mechanism by which Bibi is holding on to power. He's holding on to power because he's declared it a time of war. So therefore, as long as the status quo is it's wartime, he can maintain his power. So yeah, 2026 is the estimated time for the election. But if he declares Israel in a state of war past 2026, they won't have an election even then.
Can't they have it earlier than that anyway? Aren't they a parliamentary system? Don't they have the ability to...
Not in time of war. He has emergency powers
So if emergency powers ended, his opponents could trigger the parliamentary process and get him
removed. No, not in time of war. I believe he has Palpatine emergency powers.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That part would have to stop. Once that part stops, he could potentially be removed.
Potentially, yeah. Okay. So, whoopee. I can't wait till 2026.
I'll be happy to sit here and watch him burn it all down around him. So,
no, I think that us dissecting this article is extremely important, no matter how boring it may be for the audience, because this is the mainstream media. This is what your average citizen is reading. It's probably the only funnel that so many Americans are seeing this entire conflict through. So, it's good that we see the strategies used in these media articles to kind of shift the narrative around people like Bibi, the language being used. We're doing opposition research by analyzing this article, and it's very important opposition research, so that us on the pro-Palestinian movement side, if we come in contact with somebody who doesn't know the full situation and they're reading an article like this, we can educate them and being like, okay, look, the way that they wrote this article, the different nuances in it, it's very strategic. It's a very strategic way of taking the focus off of the Palestinian suffering and putting it on the politics surrounding and the strategies surrounding Bibi Netanyahu. And make in
I agree with you, Mark, but I think it's literally written like an article that was written in Tel Aviv by a Tel Aviv.
This is a Haaretz yeah, article.
I mean,
like,
it wouldn't be the first time. I can't, you know, again, I'm not trying to commit libel, so I'm not saying I know that time
you're actually not committing libel, because I said at the beginning of the episode, one of the co-authors of this was he literally writes for Haaretz.
Yeah. Yeah. This is a Haaretz article. Like, it reads like a Haaretz article.
But the point that I was trying to get at was there has been, you know, cases in that did make the U.S. news of U.S. journalists who have been having to clear their U.S. journalist written stories for an American audience through a Tel Aviv desk, you know, for media scrubbing. Right. And so, yeah, this is obviously one of the co-authors is from there. But like that's the message you're getting. Like, this reads like a Haaretz article, and one of the guys writes for them. But yeah, I mean, this doesn't even read like U.S. news, which is wild. But it is.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. Because it noticed the lack of concern. Like, you can just see it in the it's centering the concern around Israel getting pulled into a conflict, and not the United States getting pulled into a conflict, which you would think would be the center, since this is for an American audience from Time magazine. So it's been completely hijacked.
It's for an American audience about Israel hitting an embassy of a country that's already has an adversarial relationship with the United States. And the United States has multiple servicemen within easy reach of that nation in the region. Nowhere in this article is that mentioned.
Exactly.
Nope.
Yeah.
This is Israeli propaganda with an American media stamp on it. It's kind of crazy that it's April, 6 months in, and everybody knows it's happening, or like a lot of people do, and it's still happening, that they're putting out this shameless freaking apologist rag.
I mean, if you're the type of person who reads Time magazine and depends on Time magazine for the latest updates on something, then yeah, I can see anybody reading this falling for it. So hey, it's geared for the audience that reads Time magazine, you know? I mean,
yeah, well, as Travis mentioned, you know, Time magazine was like one of the trusted sources in his household. It wasn't mine too, so was The Economist, and look at what The Economist has done.
Yeah, my dad doesn't read it anymore, but like when I was growing up, yeah, like my dad read that, you know, it came weekly. I read it. I grew up reading it, you know, because it was in the house weekly. But yeah, they've had a fading credibility problem for quite a long time. But yeah, this is why they need to shut down TikTok, and this is why they need to censor the shit out of Instagram, because that's the only places the message is getting through, right? That's the only place the news is getting through to Americans. So
don't you miss the good old days where you can just control the radio, the TV, and the newspapers, and then you can just shove propaganda out? Yeah, the world at war. The Arabs today have invaded the Jews and committed a massacre against a lot of innocent Jews today. It's like they're thinking in terms of old school propaganda tactics and methodologies and avenues of media. You know, so it's a 1990s game being played in 2024, and it's not working really well.
It's working against people who do not consume other sources than the traditional ones, right? And that's why, you know, we've talked about this before, but that's why there's such a massive generational gap in the understanding of what's going on right now. Because if you're reading Time and The Economist and The Wall Street Journal, this is the story that you know. This is what's going on in the region right now, right? If you're not listening to Greg and Mark, you know, and people like you, you have no fucking clue, because if you only consume mainstream U.S. news, you will not see this stuff.
If only I could be a fly on the wall to hear what these conversations in the kitchens would between their parents and their kids. Like, come here, Billy. I'm going to tell you about a Time magazine article about look at this. Look what Israel has been doing with Iran. It's quite a knee slapper here. It's the generation, like you said, the generational gap is causing such an interesting dynamic in the American way of life. And Gaza is obviously, in the Palestinian struggle, is obviously going to be that centerpiece in the U.S. household between the kids and the parents.
You have to really look for it. If you go outside of social media stuff, like the streaming platforms we already talked about, and following certain content creators who are going to curate this stuff for you and do have the connections to the accurate information, you have to really, even if you go really hunting, like MSNBC Politico, even if you go hunting in the, you know, considered what are considered very left wing or left, the left side of the mainstream news, there's still very little content, right? Like I read Politico all the time, mm-hmm. Politico all the time. There's very little content there. You'd have to go look at like Al Jazeera to get it on the same format. And they're not, most Americans do not read that, right? I mean, hopefully, you know, that's shifting. They have a
dude, I've been watching Al Jazeera since the Arab Spring.
Yeah, same.
That was the only media agency that had like the most, you know, hearty content that actually had stuff that was real, like the interviews and documentaries they do. It's unmatched. And one of my questions is, how come Al Jazeera has been able to go uncompromised? Like, I don't understand how they've been managed to do that. Does anybody have thoughts on that?
Oh, hang on real quick. I mean, I love Al Jazeera. I was just on Al Jazeera Monday morning for a brief segment. So like I'm down with Al Jazeera.
Me too.
Yeah, but there has been controversy. So like I had my own bone to pick with Al Jazeera for a long time because in Afghanistan, they literally attributed a massacre to us, like U.S. Special Operations Forces in Wardak province, I believe. I think it was Wardak, or maybe it was Logar. It doesn't matter, that we didn't do. And so the only other Special Operations Force was Special Forces ODA, and we called them and be like, nah, man, we've been watching Game of Thrones all night. And it was actually the Taliban. So it wasn't us. It was them. So that really colored my view of Al Jazeera for a long time. But I think they're doing the most responsible reporting.
They are. They're amazing.
There used to be a really big split between their English language branches and their local branches. So, for example, you would go on like this is. I'm going back a decade. You would go on their like local page, the Arabic page, and it would have literally a column on the main page called conspiracy theories. Right, not something that you would be used to seeing on a mainstream journalist website. That is long since passed. And I think there's been a transition towards more and more robust journalism on the platform. But yeah, to Greg's point, there's been some stuff. But you're not going to get better information out of the region from anybody else. You can't.
You're not at all. And it's refreshing though.
Yeah, and to circle back to the whole Israel-centric thing, the reason people accept this and can accept this kind of article is because of pronounced, ingrained, deeply felt, multi-generational racism against Arabs. I don't know how else you could not give a shit about what's happening in Gaza and just focus only on Israel when they have so many accusations of genocide against them. Like, how does that happen without that? That's another aspect of this article.
What was one of the takeaway lessons from this article? If you're an aid worker, the way to not get killed by the Israeli military is to not have any brown people in your car. Because that was one of their decision-making criteria.
Yep. It was an insane confession.
Yeah. I mean, also they know that if they killed shamelessly, like all these aid workers and were like, oops, my bad, it was a mistake, all the aid would be shut down. So, you know, they would just have to like publicly cop to one mistake and then the World Central Kitchen ship will turn around. And that's exactly what happened.
Yeah. And in veterans out there, in case you missed it, there were veterans in that mix, U.S. veterans. Yep. So, yeah.
Oh, and by the way, Canada has not acknowledged at all the death of that. They haven't spoken at all. The Canadian government hasn't mentioned that guy who was on one of those in one of those vehicles.
Yeah, he was one of the personal security detachment guys.
Yep. Trudeau is silent.
All right. Well, that's that article in a nutshell. I think we need to end here so we can edit and release. And, well, I hope you guys enjoyed the breakdown. That's where the Iranian situation stands right now. Hopefully, we'll know more in a couple days. Iran still hasn't done anything publicly to respond. A lot of people thinking they might do some like cloak and dagger, ghost wars, shadow war stuff. But as of April 9th and April 10th, we don't know that yet. So either way, no matter what happens, this article is a great case study to look at for media bias. And thank you guys so much for coming on. And
And remember, kids, don't focus on the genocide happening in Gaza. Just focus around the drama and gossip surrounding Bibi Netanyahu. Keep your conscience clean.